Welcome to Equity Gurus, A Closer Look, where we take you, the investor, on a tour of some of the best small cap companies operating in the public markets today. With your host, Galen Engen.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are not necessarily shared by people who are wrong.
Welcome to Equity Gurus, A Closer Look. I'm your host, Galen Engen. Uranium has had a hard year, slipping 15.42% or $4.45 US per pound since January to $24.40 per pound. This is a far cry from the all-time high of $148 in May 2007, but still not as bad as the record low of $7.10 hit in December of 2000. Uranium markets have classically been volatile, and in 2018, many of the world's largest mines went into care and maintenance due to a buildup of surplus uranium ore. That supply is dwindling, and analysts are expecting price pressure to send uranium on an upward trajectory within the next year. Some experts believe when spot prices rise between 50 and 70 per pound, it will create enough financial incentive to reopen these large operations, as well as fund juniors looking to develop the next MacArthur River deposit, which incidentally became the world's largest uranium mine. One such junior is Canadian explorer Azincourt Energy, which trades on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol AAZ, with its flagship property in the storied Athabasca Basin. The company's East Preston project is one of the largest land positions in the prolific Patterson Lake region and is located near NextGen Energy's high-grade Arrow deposit. I'm speaking today with Alex Klenman, Azincourt Energy CEO, to get a closer look at the company, its portfolio, and what investors can expect over the next 12 months. Thanks for joining me, Alex.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Now, Alex, for those of our listeners who may not be familiar with Azincourt Energy, would you be able to give me a bit of an elevator pitch, just sort of clue me in?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, obviously, the pitch changed from late last year till now, but in terms of risk-reward, Azincourt is extremely compelling from a very logical, pragmatic standpoint. We're an explorer. We have, as you mentioned, the East Preston Project, which is located in western Athabasca. We're adjacent to Orano, Canada, or Areva, the French giant. That's they've got 50,000 hectares of Preston, and we have East Preston, which is 25,000 hectares. We're next door to NextGen, and the neighborhood is full of large cap market dollars, and we're in the right place. Obviously, the Athabasca is world-renowned for being ground zero for high-grade uranium. We have a large package there, and over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, I think we've spent close to $2 million in exploration, and we're at the drill stage now. We got a little taste of it last winter, and we're poised to do a pretty large follow-up program, and particularly in relation to our market cap, the amount of dollars we're putting into the ground. So we're excited, we're poised, and we just need a little wind in our sails in terms of the sector, and that's where the value lies right now for Azincourt.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit more about East Preston. Now, as you mentioned earlier, the Athabasca Basin is legendary. It's produced 1.4 billion pounds of the world's uranium since the Rabbit Lake discovery in 1968. Now, how does the geology at East Preston compare to the surrounding discoveries like Arrow?
Well, we're in they're similar. The only difference, I guess, on the western side of the basin is the overburden there, or lack thereof. Typically, you can go down hundreds of meters in the center of the basin, or basin proper, to get to deposits and mineralization, whereas there's much less overburden on the western side. I mean, we were drilling 200-meter holes, 150-meter holes, and that's really what we expect on that side, whereas sometimes in the basin, you know, you're going 400, 500, 600, 700 meters. So we're economically speaking, I think the western side is a better place to be, and particularly for a small explorer like Azincourt, it makes much better sense to be in an area where we can make discovery without, needing $4, 5, 6 million in the treasury.
Gotcha. Now, there were delays with permitting last year, which truncated your drill program, but even then there were positive results. Now, you had mentioned you guys are on the cusp of a 2,000-meter drill program, which is fully funded, and that's no small feat for a junior. What were the successes of your last campaign last year, and what are the goals for the upcoming program that you've got going?
Sure. Well, there's a couple things there. First of all, I think it's worth noting that typically large investment funds don't invest in micro cap juniors and particularly explorers. But that wasn't the case with Azincourt. We were able to attract several large funds into the company late last year, and that has really kind of helped us tell our story, because there's an element of legitimacy, or there's an element of due diligence that comes with that type of an investment that you know, retail investors can say, hey, that's a nice way for us to view this, because obviously somebody who's doing due diligence from a much deeper place has endorsed the project. So we like that. Late last year, when we went into the first drill program, we had funding lined up at late in 2018, and that funding basically took 6 to 8 weeks to actually come to fruition. They were late, which affected our ability to get in the ground. Gotcha. When we did get in the ground, we thought we were on target, and then there was a rapid onset spring conditions, which forced us to use helicopters, ate into the budget. Where we thought we'd get 8 to 10 holes done, we've got literally 2.5, so 552 meters. But gotcha. Within those 552 meters, we were very encouraged, and I think it's important that people understand the complexities of drilling for uranium is not basically the same thing as drilling for gold, but you either have it or you don't. We were looking for the right environment, which that box we checked off, and I'm talking about a geochemical, geophysical environment.
Gotcha.
So we had the same host rocks, the right host rocks, the right graphitic content, and then also the right pathfinder elements. These are all things that you want to kind of check off on that box. And we got all of that in a relatively short period of time. And we only got, as I mentioned, 3 holes, 2.5 holes done. And within those 552 meters, we were able to establish the prospectivity or the right environment for uranium mineralization. So we're happy about that, and really looking forward to following up with the next program that you had mentioned, which I'm happy to get into detail if you'd like.
Awesome. Yeah, please describe what you guys are looking forward to doing.
Yeah, well, all of the work that we've done has given us what we call a target inventory. These are our primary drill areas, and we've got anywhere between 25 and 35, or maybe more, I mean, if you get into it. But it depends on how we break down a target area. I mean, some people think a target area is just where one drill hole goes. We could be drilling in multiple directions in various target areas. So that leads to this larger inventory, and we were only basically able to touch a fraction of that. So this round, we hope to get 10 to 15 holes, maybe 15 holes if we're lucky, done.
Yeah.
And that should give us, that'll eat into this target inventory, but we really like what we see. What you're looking for are these conductor corridors, and we've got one large one, 16 kilometer corridor that has multiple target areas. Yep. Yeah. So we're going to get into the A corridor. I haven't actually seen the target. The guys are doing the targeting now, and that has to do with the permitting process as well, because we have some road building and things to get into. But we're well ahead of where we were last year, which is a great feeling. I think we'll be ready to go 100% when the appropriate weather arrives. But we're looking for, there's no secret here. We're looking for a uranium deposit. We're looking for a discovery.
Yep.
And I think it's important to mention as well that I think these funds that got involved with Azincourt did so because there's an absolute need for exploration discovery. And that part of the equation, that part of the supply chain, if you will, must be pursued. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important. So we'd like to be that next discovery, and we think we're in the right area. That if in fact that comes to fruition, it will be amplified appropriately because of where we are and who the neighbors are.
Gotcha. And digging for uranium is a little more tricky than just going for gold or any kind of other mineral.
Yeah.
You're often doing like 200 plus holes trying to determine your resource and where it is and where you can get at it, correct?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned that at MacArthur River, which everyone knows is the largest, resource on the planet. I think they were well into the 200s before they actually made the discovery. Gotcha. Now, technology has changed. Scientifically speaking, you don't have to spend as much time as they did at that time. Gotcha. But it gives you an idea of these types of things. I mean, this isn't a 2-3 hole, what in some in the business call a drill and kill.
Gotcha.
We could be drilling for a couple of years before we've actually determined what person right. has or doesn't have.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So I keep talking when I talk to investors and potential investors, I talk about this being, the baseball analogy. We're in a 9-inning game, and we're in literally in the first or second inning here.
Gotcha.
We have a long way to go before we determine what we have. And I think that also was one of the reasons why we got institutional support.
Gotcha.
It's a massive project with a lot of targets, and we're just starting the most critical process, which is drilling.
Gotcha.
You're listening to the Equity.Guru podcast.
Just a quick note to tell you, sorry to interrupt your interview, but if you want more of these, you need to go to your podcast player, whatever that podcast player is, and go and subscribe to the Equity Guru podcast. You can do that through iTunes. You can do it through Google Play. You can do it through all the places. Equity Guru podcast. Do it now.
Welcome back.
Now, for many of the reasons that you've just mentioned, junior explorers are just naturally a speculative buy because of the nature of their work. But good companies position themselves to minimize risk for their shareholders. Now, this warrant extension announced in February, according to our resident mining expert, Greg Nolan, created a marriage contract between a major fund manager and Azincourt Energy, which illustrates to me that the fund is all in for the next 5 years. They obviously found a reason to stick with your program, right? But I want to know from you, what are the major factors that de-risk Azincourt's East Preston project? We've talked about the depth. We've talked about funding. What else?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's data. Everything's driven by data. And we've, over the course of since 2013, 2014, when the JV was struck with Sky Harbor and Clean Commodities and the original Azincourt Uranium Company, mm-hmm. There's been a lot of money spent on de-risking. So every single VTEM survey we do or geophysical survey or geochemical testing that is done de-risks to some degree because you're adding data to make your case. Either it looks like there could be something there or it doesn't look like something's there.
Right.
To date, we've done everything. We've got all the signatures of unconformity, basement-hosted uranium deposits, all of the geographical, geophysical characteristics that you look for, and so we're checking those boxes off with each of the exploration programs that we've done. Nothing that we've done has come up empty in terms of data. So that's a great thing to point to and say, hey, this just keeps pointing in the right direction. It just keeps edging towards that discovery hole. Now, discovery holes, Mother Nature has a great curveball, again, to use the baseball analogy. Sometimes you run into these things where you just, at the end of the day, the story isn't that you missed it. How did you miss with all that data? So we're a long way from that, but we do have a ton of data that suggests, and it was really sort of confirmed mostly by the three holes or the 2.5 holes we got done last year.
Gotcha.
They told us a lot about what we were seeing above ground, and now that we're actually seeing it in the ground, it's exciting, and we're going to get 15 holes done if all goes well, and I think there could be something special in there.
Awesome. No, I'm sure there's going to be something coming out of that one. Now, uranium is a common metal like zinc or tin, and it's found in low concentrations in most rocks and even in the ocean. Therefore, it isn't necessarily a surprise to uncover economical deposits of it across the globe. But in 2017, 44% of the world's uranium was mined in Australia and Kazakhstan, with Canada placing a distant third. Now, does this trade relationship create a certain degree of unease when it comes to supply chain security? And how positioned is Canada to take up any slack that might occur?
Yeah, well, common sense tells you that anything coming out of the Eastern Bloc, like Kazakhstan, for example, is going to face a greater scrutiny and more hurdles than anything coming out of more friendly jurisdictions to the western side of the planet. Canada has been, we know that, listen, 15% of the world's high-grade uranium comes from the Athabasca. So we're in a great position. I mean, you're going to pick two or three spots in the world. Athabasca is one of them. to do what we do. So we're happy about that. And I think, you know, I mean, yeah, there's going to be with what's going on south of the border, there's a greater emphasis on dealing with friendlies, quote unquote. So Australia, Canada will probably see bumps in that, but there's more reactors coming online than ever before. There's more in the planning and in the construction phase. And there's just no way when you look at supply demand dynamics that this sector, this situation isn't going to maybe snap like a rubber band like it did in 2007 and to a lesser extent 2010-11. Yeah.
Now, speaking of which, you know, much depends right now on uranium's rebound from this year's dip. Now, it's right that might seem challenging at first blush, but not necessarily. I mean, we've got gas and coal still dominating. Natural gas generated electricity made up 27.9% of the global grid in 2018. Coal made up 25.6%. So they both kind of trounced nuclear and hydro, which sat at 17.7% and 13.4% respectively. Now, with such a considerable divide, what do you think might be some of the imminent triggers that would propel atomic energy past hydro and carbon-based sources like coal and gas?
Well, I think really, I mean, everything was sort of going so far away from coal until our friend got into office south of the border, and then coal suddenly woke up from what was, you know, a decreasing trend, descending trend. So what we see here is, I mean, look, it's obviously shifting. We're seeing, as I mentioned, more reactors online and in the planning and construction phases than ever before. That tells you we're only going in one direction. I mean, particularly China, India, these countries are going to lean heavily on it. And the U.S. as well. I mean, the U.S., the reason we're at $24 spot is the 2-2 initiative in the U.S. basically just threw a huge wet blanket over everything. The U.S. utilities were typically one of, if not the largest buyers in the world of product, simply could not enter long-term contracts with 232 looming. They needed to know if they were going to buy 25% of their supply from domestic suppliers. And even if that did go through, and, you know, there's still a chance it will, but it won't, I don't think. But even if it did, I mean, you can't, U.S. suppliers are not in a position to meet the 25% demand. It's impossible. Gotcha. There's just not enough there. So it was really mostly window dressing, I think, for the administration down there to say, you know, kind of put America first and these types of things. But at the end of the day, we're going to see the demand once these utilities go back in the market. I mean, let's look back historically at those price spikes in spot. They are dramatic vertical ascensions.
Yes.
So they don't just creep up over a period of time. They spike and they go hard. And it typically, historically, the majority of long-term contracts are signed at the highs. They're not signed at the lows. And that is because really in the overall scheme of things, the price of the uranium for utilities is a very small percentage of their outlay. Gotcha. So there's much smarter people talking about the supply demand dynamics. Everybody who's placing their bets in this sector right now are content and firm on what they think is going to happen. And if you look at it, I mean, logically speaking, the only thing that can derail it is a black swan. But even that, I don't think would happen, would have much of an effect, honestly, because you're going to have to turn all of these utilities will have to flip the switch.
Gotcha.
So supply is needed, and the demand is just sort of percolating here, waiting to go. Look, we were 28 spot last December.
Right.
Could easily be back there in a heartbeat.
Okay. No, that sounds reasonable. It is a volatile market, most definitely. As you said, it spikes, and it goes hard. Now, is there anything else that you'd like to add, Alex, that we haven't covered already that you think investors might need to know in regards to Azincourt Energy and its pursuits?
Sure. I mean, look, I mean, my job is to make Azincourt appear as attractive as possible to investors, but I don't have to pitch it too hard. And when you look at it, I mean, we're trading at, you know, 2.5, 3 cents, 3.5 in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Our market cap is, you know, relatively low. We have, you know, $1.6 million in the bank, and we're trading at, you know, to what am I, 2.5 million market cap, 3 million market cap. So, and with institutional support, which is a verification, an endorsement of, to a certain degree that, that people can look at. But we're heading into a drill season. And if we time this correctly, if we get our drills down this winter and we come back to the market in the first quarter, 2020, mm-hmm. we come back in the first quarter 2020 with some results, and spot is up near 30 or has reached that $30 mark. Gotcha. I just don't see us being a 2.5 cent, 3.5 cent, you know, entry point. I spent a long time on the phone today with a longtime investor who's, mm-hmm. you know, been waiting it out. It's not like we're alone and AssetCore has been hammered, in isolation. That mm-hmm. the entire uranium sector, all the producers and other explorers are all trading at 52-week lows or thereabouts. And, you know, so that makes us feel better to some degree that it's not an isolated thing with the company.
Exactly.
So we're banking on the sector turning, getting a little wind in the sails. Wind in the sails is the far largest factor in this business. Gotcha. And when, you know, you can drop a breadcrumb on the ground and one pigeon will pick it up, or you can drop a breadcrumb and 40 pigeons will fight for the breadcrumb. When you get into a good market, yep. That breadcrumb typically is attacked, and we're just waiting. I mean, we if we come back in that first quarter 2020, even second quarter 2020 with good results, mm-hmm. Decent results that continue the discovery narrative that we're on, definitely. Then I think we're certainly looking at a better evaluation than we are today.
Awesome. So in the end, is AssetCore a speculative buy? For sure. But the explorer has a trust of institutional money, a huge land position in a prolific district, and a market cap of $3.59 million when surrounding explorers ring in above the $15 million mark, all the way to $1 billion BMS. So definitely headroom for growth for any savvy investor looking to capitalize on the 21st century power grid. Once again, you can find AssetCore Energy on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol AAZ. Thanks for joining me today, Alex.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.
Anytime. We've got to have you back on soon.
You bet.
All right. You've been listening to Equity Gurus A Closer Look with your host, Galen Engen. See you next time.
Thanks for listening. For disclosure statements and more info, please visit www.equity.guru.